This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ayes Wuhim in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Because they look innocent and they have been radicalized and present a dilemma, because in observance or rule of engagement, you can't just see any child and start, you know, shooting or killing the child.
That's Senator Irigbu, founder of the online security magazine The Global Sentinel, on militants' use of child soldiers. Details coming up. Also, the military has seized power in Burkina Faso. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The military in Burkina Faso has seized power and President Roch Kabore is being held at a military camp. Reporter Henry Wilkins is in Ouagadougou and he spoke with VOA's Kate Pond Dawson about the situation. He explains, after 6 years of conflict with Islamist militants and regional bandits, many in Burkina Faso have lost confidence in Kabore's government to bring peace. Two large massacres last year particularly drove public anger, and people in November took to the streets to protest. Kabore reacted by ordering a crackdown on protests and firing many military commanders and some of his cabinet. But Wilkins says over the weekend, things change.
Protests then occurred again on Saturday this week. But were quickly put down by local police using tear gas. The following day, the largest military base in Ouagadougou mutinies. I actually managed to get into that military base yesterday after being detained for about half an hour by the mutineers, who then gave us a list of their demands before setting us free. Their demands included the replacement of the chief of the army, the chief of the intelligence service, more troops to fight the war against the terror groups, and better treatment of the families of the military dead who have died in the conflict.
Now, Burkina Faso has been part of the G5 Sahel effort to contain extremist violence, rebel violence around the region. Is this likely to affect that relationship with the other G5 Sahel nations or with the partners such as France?
I mean, that is still up for grabs at the moment. There does seem to be a rising anti-French sentiment in Burkina Faso late last year. A French military convoy, which was travelling from neighbouring Ivory Coast through to Niger and Mali, where French forces are stationed, was stopped by protesters in Burkina Faso at several different locations throughout the country. There is a sense here amongst many within the G5, within the Sahel, and certainly in neighbouring Mali, which is also part of the G5 Sahel, there does seem to be a sense that the status quo with military assistance from France and the international community, including the US and the EU, doesn't seem to be working. As to whether this new government will be willing to cooperate with France or whether it will look to change the status quo, that is still unclear at this point.
That was journalist Wilkins speaking by phone from Ouagadougou with my colleague Kate Pond Dawson. Wilkins was outside the grounds of the state broadcaster, which the military has taken over. He said journalists were waiting for an announcement from the leader of the soldiers who detained Kabore, Colonel Paul Henry Damiba. Also, the Economic Community of West African States a few hours ago condemned what it called an attempted coup in Burkina Faso. A study by Africa Center for Strategic Studies warns that the recent spate of coup d'etats in Africa is becoming contagious because successful takeovers significantly increased the probability of subsequent ones. VOA's senior analyst Mohamed Ashnawi has the details.
The past 2 years brought coups in Mali, Chad, Guinea, Sudan, Tunisia, and arguably Algeria and Burundi, many of which were navigating democratic transitions. The study traced this streak to coups in Egypt and Zimbabwe a few years earlier and says Africa thus risks hurtling back to the military misgovernance of the 60s. Joseph Siegel, the author of the study, points out that Africa coup plotters believed they could succeed without worrying about external costs on the regional level because of the Organization of African Union's policy of non-interference. However, in the year 2000, the African Union altered this calculation, subjecting a junta to potential suspension, sanctions, and the threat of intervention. These costs were amplified by penalties from Western democracies and international organizations. Nevertheless, the study indicates that the recent rise in coups reflects growing unwillingness by regional and international actors to enforce anti-takeover norms.
The lack of a strong response on the part of regional organizations, specifically the African Union, ECOWAS, IGAD, this has enabled these coups and has created something of a contagion effect. So, you know, when these coups have happened, the regional bodies have rhetorically condemned them, but they haven't followed up with very concrete and significant action.
If international actors refuse to recognize coups, then the plotters are politically isolated and denied access to a state sovereign financial accounts. By treating takeovers as an unfortunate but normal means of transferring power in Africa, they inadvertently help to consolidate power grabs. The latest military coup in Africa took place in Sudan, led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan last October. It has continued to use lethal force against peaceful demonstrators. The international actors have yet to exert tough pressure to restore the country's democratic transition. The UN started mediation efforts, which are reaching an impasse, as civil society organizations in Sudan insist on excluding the military from politics. Mona Jul, Norway's ambassador to the UN, pointed out the need for unity in the UN Security Council.
It is extremely important that we as a council express our views that we don't accept, a military takeover, and that we encourage democratic processes and transition into a democratic way of conducting government. Because the message, if it's unified from the council, I think make quite a lot of impression on the people on the ground.
Siegel maintains that the most significant action to reverse the takeover trend is to consistently impose real costs. But the Biden administration has been overwhelmed with the number of coups in Africa, as Thomas Caruthers of Carnegie Endowment for International Peace explains.
There have been coups in Guinea, Mali, Chad of a sort, presidential self-coup in Tunisia, coup in Sudan. They've been trying in these different countries to draw some lines and say the United States is trying to push governments to articulate a path back to civilian, pluralistic, elected rule. It's trying to impose sanctions where appropriate. In Sudan, I think the administration's been struggling a bit.
However, he said the U.S. should pressure General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan in order to reverse the consequences of the military's takeover. The U.S. embassy in Sudan said the Biden administration has no intention of resuming economic assistance that was paused after the coup unless the violence ends and a civilian-led government is restored. The study concludes that if the West wants to help stem the rash of destabilizing coups, it needs to be a steadfast champion of democracy in Africa. There was a reason the international community broadly worked to eliminate coups in the post-Cold War period, and the same rationale persists today. The question is whether international actors remember the script. Mohamed El-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
A video released by the Nigerian terrorist group Islamic State West Africa Province appears to show armed children executing two military officers. Security experts say the recruitment of Nigerian children into violent extremism is hampering efforts by authorities to end the insurgency. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The 27-minute-long video was released Tuesday by Site Intelligence Group, a jihadist monitoring organization. In the video, young militants around 12 years old are seen shooting two men in the head who are dressed in Nigeria military uniforms. The video also shows many young fighters receiving military training. Nigeria military authorities have yet to issue a statement on the video. This is not the first time armed groups have released video of child soldiers executing abductees. But security analysts are concerned the latest video will undercut claims by authorities they are gaining ground in the battle against terrorists. Senator Irebu is the founder of the online security magazine, The Global Sentinel.
Where is concerning, apart from that this violates the rights of these children, is the element of continuity, because they are indoctrinating these children right from the young age, and it presents a problem. That means they are planning about their association ahead of time.
This week, the military said troops rescued 16 abductees and that 863 terrorists quit Boko Haram. But experts say the recruiting of young fighters makes it more difficult to defeat terror groups and can hamper the efforts of the authorities. Security intelligence groups say child soldiers are often used by the terrorists as spies and informants to gather intelligence from target communities.
Because they look innocent, they have been radicalized and present a dilemma, because in observance or rule of engagement, you can't just see any child and start, you know, shooting or killing the child.
UNICEF says some 95,000 children were recruited globally between 2005 and 2020, and that more than 3,500 were recruited by militants in Nigeria between 2013 and 2017. In the past, Boko Haram often used children as suicide bombers, a practice that attracted widespread criticism. Security analyst Ebenezer Oyetakin says poverty helps drive kids into the arms of terrorists.
The most important way to win this kind of a war is to ensure that, in the first place, we enlarge the basis of our economy as a nation. A country of 200 million people should have a minimum of over 1 trillion in GDP, because we cannot win this battle only by the kinetic engagement. We must also win it in the belly of our children, in their self-esteem, in their capacity to care for themselves.
Islamic State West Africa Province split off from Boko Haram in 2016. The group's activities raise concerns about Islamic State expanding its enclaves to West Africa. Both Boko Haram and ISWAP are fighting an anti-government war to create their own Islamic caliphate in northeastern Nigeria. UNICEF says the war has killed more than 300,000 people and displaced millions more. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
In South Africa, voices are being raised against several high-profile global management consultancy and auditing firms after a report by a commission of inquiry implicated them in corruption. The companies, including Bain & Company, McKinsey and PricewaterhouseCoopers, deny they knowingly participated in former President Jacob Zuma's so-called State Capture Project. The commission says Zuma appointed political allies and private companies to help him capture state-owned enterprises, or SOEs, and loot them. Darren Taylor has more.
The report, written by Commission Chair Judge Raymond Zondo, implies that the firms knew exactly what they were doing when the Zuma administration used them to restructure public entities such as South Africa's Tax Collection Agency and National Airline. Guided by auditors and consultants, says Zondo, Zuma appointees hollowed out SOEs to the point of dysfunction and bankruptcy in exchange for hundreds of millions of rands. The companies implicated in graft acknowledge they made mistakes, but vehemently deny involvement in financial crimes. A former executive for the Bain consultancy, Athol Williams, exposed its alleged collusion in corruption when he testified at the inquiry last year.
I had to leave the country because of concerns around my safety. We've seen the last few days two other state capture whistleblowers have break-ins to their homes. We live in constant fear. We live under constant threat, and there's no support from our government at all. I haven't received a single phone call, email.
Bain has dismissed Williams' evidence against it, suggesting he has no direct knowledge of how it helped Zuma's friend, Tom Moyane, restructure the South African Revenue Service, or SARS.
Bain says I wasn't an employee at the time when they were dismantling SARS, and so therefore we should disregard my testimony. What they don't say is that actually my testimony relies on actual Bain documents of conversations that happened during that time.
The documents that Williams gave to the commission appear to show that Bain and Moyane identified highly experienced tax officials who subsequently lost their jobs at SARS. Zuma officials then moved into the posts and the tax agency began bleeding money. Bain has not denied that the documents are genuine, adding it may have unwittingly damaged SARS.
My frank advice to Bain is when in a hole, stop digging.
Lord Peter Hayne is a former British parliamentarian who was born in South Africa. He is leading an international campaign lobbying for prosecution of corporations allegedly involved in corruption in the country. Hayne describes Zondo's report as a detailed and damning indictment of how some private conglomerates collude with governments to steal public money. He's particularly angered at Boston-based Bain's stance.
At least McKinsey and KPMG offered apologies. At least their global executives flew to South Africa to try and put things right, and people were sat. At least they came to engage with me in London in my office in the House of Lords after I'd exposed there what was happening in front of the British Parliament. With Bain and Company, there's virtually no admission that anything went wrong. My advice is simply to come clean to the South African public, admit their guilt, and try to put it right.
Williams says prosecutors should use his documentary evidence to build a case against Bain for its alleged role at SARS.
They actively worked around the procurement rules and processes continuously. And in fact, we know that their contract that they won was for 2.6 million rand for 6 weeks. They stayed there for 2.5 years and earned 200 million rand. This is not unwitting. This is intentional, conscious action.
At the very least, says Zondo, the privates knew they were being used to destroy South African institutions, but they turned a blind eye and accepted the work anyway. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The Democratic Republic of Congo's military, the Uganda's People's Defense Force and the United Nations Force have agreed to work together to defeat the rebel Allied Democratic Forces. When Uganda's UPDF began its operation in the eastern DRC last year, it was not coordinating with the UN force known as MONUSCO. Reporter Jafar Al-Kitanti explains Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni had reservations about MONUSCO.
Ugandan forces would not allow the UN forces to work with them. And President Museveni said MONUSCO is in DRC for more than 20 years and they did nothing, so we can't work with them. We finally accept to work together, and in the end of meeting, the Congolese spokesperson of the FRDC said they talked about who will do what and where.
In the end, Atlantanti's report, MONUSCO's greater logistics capability and its long record in the region led the DRC and Ugandan forces to coordinate their efforts. The ADF originated in Uganda and has been based in eastern DRC since the 1990s. It is blamed for thousands of deaths over the past decade as it has raided villages and attacked businesses. Last May, the DRC government imposed a state of siege on North Kivu and Ituri provinces in an effort to contain the ADF. However, the military government now in charge in two provinces is becoming unpopular. The new government with MONUSCO has some people in the region saying the state of siege should end.
Saturday in Goma, there was a protest against state of siege. And this morning in Beni, there is a protest against state of siege.
Al-Kitanti reports the police cracked down on demonstrators.
All of the two protests were being attacked by police using tear gas. And on Saturday, we recorded more than 10 injured and 7 arrested.
It is not yet clear how many people were injured or arrested at the protest today in Beni. Jafar Al-Kitanti is a journalist based in Goma in the eastern DRC. He spoke earlier with my colleague, Kate Brown Dawson. South Africa's indigenous Khoi and San people are in court to block construction of the planned African headquarters for online retail giant Amazon. Opponents say the project will run a historically significant riverside site and harm the environment. Linda Giftash reports from Johannesburg.
Closing arguments are being heard Friday in a court battle over riverside land in Cape Town. The site is slated to be developed into a 70,000 square meter complex that will house the African headquarters of Amazon, along with other businesses. City authorities approved construction of the 9-story complex last year, but some indigenous Khoisan leaders and community groups are trying to reverse the decision, saying it undermines the city's own heritage and environmental standards. Torque Jenkins is High Commissioner of the Gorangai Kona Khoikhoi Indigenous Traditional Council, which is among the groups fighting the project.
We're in a situation where a terrain that is so sacred to the healing of our country is not just under threat, but being damaged and destroyed as we speak.
Construction has already begun at the site, which is currently occupied by a restaurant and golf course. Property owners, Lisbic Leisure Properties Trust, LLPT, says it did consult indigenous groups while planning the site's redevelopment. In a statement, company spokesperson James Tannenberger says the opposing community group and Indigenous Council led by Jenkins, quote, have been driving a misinformation campaign after their concerns were validly dismissed by the competent authorities during the comprehensive 3-year development approval process. Tannenberger says other Indigenous leaders have given their approval to the project. He says the new site will also pay tribute to their history by including a museum and memorial site, along with creating low-income housing and jobs. The current divide within the indigenous community is complex. The Khoikhoi and San were some of the country's first inhabitants, and their presence in the southern tip of Africa dates back thousands of years. Their lands were lost to colonial settlements in the 1600s. June Bam Hutchinson is a researcher with the Center for African Studies at the University of Cape Town.
The enslaved, the oppressed, the exploited, their language was also taken away, their culture was taken away, their knowledge systems that could have helped us in so many ways to build a more peaceful and healthy society that has also taken away.
She says their unique cultural identity was only acknowledged by South Africa in more recent decades.
Today, they are now being recognized. It took some time. The land question remains very much unresolved, highly disputed.
The riverside development is contentious because of the site's history. The Khoisan say it lies on a battlefield where they defended their territory from Portuguese colonizers in 1510. Jenkins says losing the case would set a dangerous precedent for giving up historic sites to corporate interests. Amazon declined to comment on the matter. The company does not own the site, but will be leasing the space once constructed. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Tunisia has upset Nigeria to advance to the Africa Cup of Nations quarterfinals, despite 7 of its players and its coach isolated because of COVID-19. According to Reuters, Nigeria, the only team to win all the games in its group's phase, has been the overwhelming favorite to advance yesterday. But it seemed Nigeria could not get any flow. The ejection of Alex Iwobi for a dangerous tackle in the 66th minute did not help either. A long-range shot by Captain Youssouf Maskane gave Tunisia an improbable 1-0 win. It was a remarkable turnaround for Tunisia, whose group matches included an embarrassing 1-0 defeat to tiny Gambia 3 days ago. In today's matches, Guinea faces Gambia and Cameroon battles Comoros. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia.